Hi, it's Casey Truffo, and I have on the line with me Bill O'Hanlon. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Casey. How are you doing?
Great, great. I've been so excited about this because you're going to be one of our VIP faculty at our Therapist Leadership Conference, and you, in fact, were the very first person that I asked when I decided that we really needed to have a virtual conference. And I just love your sense of humor and the way that you carry yourself and the way that you share your wisdom with us. And just, first of all, I just want to thank you for that. I mean, that's really been fun and informative for me, so thank you for that.
Well, thanks. You know, this conference really fits two of my main things. You know, I like to get up in the morning and change the world and contribute to the world. And also, I'd like to be at a place where I don't have to show up to actually do it. I just have to be in my, you know, blue jeans and my T-shirt. And, you know, so this is my goal, to influence the world in a positive way and never have to go anyplace, never even have to leave my wonderful house in Santa Fe that's nice and sunny and breezy and not have to get dressed up. So this is perfect for me.
Oh, that's great, great. And I think that it's going to be fun for the attendees also because
they can wear whatever they
exactly.
want.
Exactly.
They can absolutely wear whatever. They can be naked listening to this. They really are into kinky conferences.
For us women, it's like, oh, we don't have to put on makeup. We love that idea. So
that is good.
It's very great. Well, you know, one of the things that I've always enjoyed about you is just your effervescence, your humor, the way that you carry yourself is just so much fun. But I think that you weren't always as outgoing as you are now. Is that right?
That is true. I was painfully shy until my mid-20s. I certainly would have never imagined that I would be doing any speaking on a stage in front of people. I couldn't talk in front of more than one person, except if I knew them really well, my family or friends. I wasn't super quiet. I was very quiet when I was younger, but in my 20s I started to talk more, but only to people I was really comfortable with, that I was in a small, intimate, you know, setting with, and certainly not standing on a stage. And, you know, I just never imagined that. I was very shy, and I was also anxious and kind of depressed. I was very depressed when I was a late adolescent. I got really depressed, which is sort of what got me into this topic of positive psychology.
Yes.
I was so depressed that I kind of lost my moorings. I lost my sense of meaning. You know, you just grow up, and I wasn't even thinking about that when I grew up. I grew up, you know, in a big family, and you just did what you did, and there were always people around. When I went to college, I got a lot more isolated. And I also, you know, you start studying philosophy and questioning everything when you first go to college, and I just started questioning everything. It was a hippie time, and there was a lot of societal questioning going on, and I just thought, it's all fake, nothing has any meaning, and I just lost my meaning in addition to becoming really depressed. And I just slept a lot, stayed alone a lot, which, you know, I realized later when I became a therapist and started treating people who were depressed, that depression is one of these problems that calls you to be isolated. It kind of invites you to stare. You think, oh, I'm a burden on other people, or other people don't understand me, or I can't relate to other people, or it takes too much energy to even talk to people. And so that isolation, I think, usually makes the depression a lot worse. But for me, it was a combination of depression and meaninglessness, which was pretty bleak time in my life. And I almost killed myself. It's a long story, but a friend talked me out of it. And then I thought, okay, now I'm here. What do I do? How do people get out of bed? How do people figure out a reason and a meaning for their lives, a reason to get out of bed and do something? What makes a difference? And that became kind of my new purpose. I was thinking, well, I've got to figure out what makes life meaningful, what makes life less painful and more meaningful. And I became obsessed with how do people find a reason and a purpose to live. And that led me in a lot of directions, but one of the first ones that really made sense to me was discovering the work of this late psychiatrist, Milton Erickson, who was alive when I was in Arizona, and I happened to meet him by accident. I worked at an art gallery that he came to buy something at Arizona State, and I became fascinated with his work, and he was a person who was endlessly creative and what I would say is sort of psychotically optimistic about people's possibilities to change. He never met a person he didn't think could change. And
wow.
It was just a matter of how do you approach them in a creative way and how do you help them change. So he considered nobody resistant, but everybody cooperating sort of in their own weird way, even if they looked resistant. And that kind of hopefulness and optimism, you know, certainly touched me because I felt like, wow, I'm not a basket case, and I changed, you know, before I met Erickson. I came out of a really deep depression. Now I have a pretty good life. But he believes that about everybody, and that sort of infected me, this positive and resource-oriented view of people, and I just was converted fairly instantly once I studied with him, once I started reading his work, and that influenced the rest of my clinical career.
Wow. But we didn't talk about positive psychology back when you were starting to become a therapist. We didn't really frame it that way.
There was no such thing. There were a few people who were kind of looking at the light side rather than the dark side of human nature. Abraham Maslow had looked at peak experiences and what the kind of those transcendental and transcendent moments in people's lives were and studying peak experiences. That was kind of cool. Carl Rogers thought that people, like Erickson, that people had kind of a healthy core. So there was some background. William James in the 1800s had looked at religious experiences and the varieties of religious experiences, some of those positive experiences and how people had them. But for the most part, for 100 years, sort of under the influence of Freud, we looked at really how people were damaged, deficient, and pathological. And that was the main orientation. Now, Erickson came along and had a big influence on me and thought, what works in people's lives? What do they do right? And I created a whole approach out of my work with Erickson called the solution-oriented approach. So I was applying this stuff in clinical work. And in the early 90s, I started to hear these trickling reports. People would tell me, there's this guy out in Pennsylvania, and he's doing something similar but in research psychology. And I said, yeah, what is that? And I'd heard his name, Martin Seligman, because he'd done research on depression and learned helplessness,
right.
Sort of a certain, kind of set of characteristics that depressed people seem to have. There are kind of explanatory styles that they used. They were more likely to blame themselves and feel like they couldn't do anything about their depression. And so I'd known his name as a research psychologist, but he started to get really into both supporting and publicizing the research on the parts of human life that worked, both what helped people be happier, so there's happiness studies, and also what made for what he called, after Aristotle, the good life. What helped people live a life that they thought was meaningful and useful and deeply satisfying. So he started to bring together a bunch of researchers, and he named the field, I believe. He was the one who came up with the name positive psychology, which I think in some ways is a little unfortunate. It's not all positive. It's a little more subtle and nuanced than that. But it's a good enough name, and a lot of research has been done now over the last 15 years, and we're learning really interesting things.
And you're going to be teaching us at the conference how to take that then into the room?
Right, because it's a bunch of research psychologists, a bunch of statistics wonks and, behavioral psychologists.
Right.
They're going into labs and studying this stuff, which is great. I'm glad they do that. I don't have the patience to do that. And my statistics, although I did okay in my statistics class, I don't have a fascination with those regressions toward the mean kind of thing. And so these people are people who understand that stuff, but they're not clinicians. They're not therapists.
Yeah.
And so they've discovered all this really interesting stuff, and it's kind of hard to keep up on all the literature. There have been a bunch of books recently that are summaries of it, but there's research coming all the time. There's Journal of Happiness Studies, and there's a bunch of research coming out, but they don't tell you what do you do when someone walks in your office based on these cool things that they're discovering in happiness research and meaningful life research and life satisfaction research and what they call subjective well-being. That stuff all comes out of the lab, but it's not obvious how to bring it into the clinical room. And I thought, well, because I've been doing this clinical work for 25 years now, this kind of positive psychology clinical work, I have some understanding about what works and what doesn't clinically, and also how to talk about that. And now I've had this fascination for the last, some years with all this positive psychology research. I'm a little obsessive when I get into something. I read everything. I have a really interesting life because I teach and I write, and I have a lot of time on my hands between teaching and writing. I stopped my clinical practice a couple of years ago after over 30 years of being a clinician, And so now I can just dive deeply into this stuff, which most clinicians don't have. They're trying to make a living. They're trying to see their clients, return phone calls, do their case notes, things like
right,
that.
Right, right.
So I've become the ambassador, I think, to therapy land from clinical, from positive psychology, from positive psychology research, and how do you translate it into what do you do with a person when they walk into your room? Because you can't just tell them about the research and say, go out and use this. There is a lot more subtle ways to apply it, and that's what we're going to be talking about at the conference.
And I think that's helpful because I know that in some of the positive psychology research, we've seen one or two exercises of things we can give as homework assignments to clients. But there's more depth beyond that, and I know that, and I'm sure you're going to be sharing that with us.
Yeah, I mean, Oprah has told us to be grateful, and that's
right.
One of the things that comes out of positive psychology research, and that's a terrific thing to do. But what if the client says, I've got nothing to be grateful for. All my
right.
life has been terrible, and I'm bitter, and I'm angry, and I, you know... The gratitude exercise probably is not going to be for them, and or they're not going to do it. It might be for them, but they're not going to do it. How do you get people on board with this stuff, and what are the more nuanced ways, rather than just say, read a positive psychology book and do an exercise on forgiveness or an exercise on gratitude, and those are two things that have come out of the research. There are hundreds of things that come out of the research, and you've got to personalize them to the person in front of you, and you can't just be didactic. I think you've got to be clinical and connective and relational and, you know, adapt this stuff to the particular clinical situation that you're in, and that's where the skill comes in. And these research psychologists aren't very good at that stuff. They like group the data rather than individual. Psychotherapy is always an N of one, isn't it?
Exactly, and you are the ambassador of this, and we're really looking forward to what you have to say. I remember sitting in the room with a client saying, I want you to write down the three things you're grateful for every day, and the best things that happen to you and why they happen. The person just looks at me, you know, I'm suicidal.
Oh, you're insane.
Yeah.
You're
and
the
I'm thinking,
one who needs therapy now. Yeah, really.
You know, well, there was a huge therapeutic break that happened
because
it's clear I wasn't responding to where the client was.
Well,
so,
you know, you tend to be, and I tend to be in this phase of my life, a little psychotically optimistic myself.
Absolutely.
You tend to be, you know, you're a very upbeat person, you're a very positive person, you're a very can-do person, and sometimes we have to kind of dampen that to join our people in the hopelessness and keep one foot in the hopelessness and one foot in the hopefulness, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about is how do you bridge the gap between when people are in really desperate, terrible suffering. And you do want to bring some of this stuff in because it will be helpful for them. But how do you join them in that desperation and suffering and hopelessness and invite them into some of this positive psychology place? And there are three specific techniques I'll talk about bridging that gap. But then again, many other things that we'll talk about in the time that we have at the conference.
I am just so excited about this. I mean, you... For, like we said, your sense of humor is just amazing and fun and really keeps us going on one hand, and you take things that can be tough times, you know, things that we talk about in the room, tough decisions we have to make, clinical ideas, and you make those easy and fun, and we're just so excited. And for those of you that are thinking about joining the conference, we really hope you will. Bill will be talking on his topic called From Positive Psychology to Effective Psychotherapy, and his presentation will be on Tuesday, April 21st, 2009, and that's 9 a.m. Pacific or 12 Eastern. And for those of you that aren't sure you can make it at that time, no worries. We're going to have MP3 files you can download and listen at your leisure. And we're just so excited, Bill. You're one of our first speakers, so we're really excited. And thanks for spending this time with me.
Oh, I'm looking forward to the whole conference myself. I think this is great. I'm going to stay in my blue jeans and T-shirt, and I'm going to get the whole thing right from here, and I get to hang out in sunny Santa Fe listening and watching, and it's going to be great. I'm so looking forward to it. You have so many great people that I've wanted to hear, and I don't get a chance to hear very much because I'm teaching all the time, so this is great.
Well, that's one of the things, Bill, that we tried to do in this conference was you tried to make nobody opposite each other, because that was one of the things that bothered me, is that if I were speaking or attending one, I couldn't get the others.
You and I both go to these conferences, and there are two things that happen. One is you're on at the same time as somebody else, so you can't see them. The other thing is there are too many things to see at the same time.
Exactly.
So you can't, you know, I want to go see two of those, and I can only see one. I can't clone myself. That's great. You know, even if you can't even do the time, you can listen to the replay later. I think that's great.
Exactly. Well, thank you, and we'll look forward to seeing you on Tuesday, April 21st, as well as you're going to be part of our kickoff, I think, too, on Monday. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Great.
Thank
Great, great. Well, great, Bill. Thanks for spending the time with us, and we'll see you at the conference.
Thanks, Casey.